Lalyamanam Janairevam
Lalyamanam Janairevam
Dhruvam Sabrataram Dvipaha
Dhruvam Sabrataram Dvipaha
Aropya Karinim Hrishtaha
Aropya Karinim Hrishtaha
Stuyamano Vishatpuram
Stuyamano Vishatpuram
Lalyamanam. Being thus praised, Janai, by the people in general, Evam, thus, Dhruvam, Maharaj Dhruva, Sabrataram, with his brother, Nripaha, the king, Arupya, placing Karinin on the back of a she elephant. Rishtaha, being so pleased, Stuyamanaha, and being so praised, Avishat, returned, Puram, to his capital. The sage Maitreya continued, my dear Vidura, when everyone was thus praising Dhruva Maharaj, the king was very happy, and he had Dhruva and his brother seated on the back of a she-elephant. Thus he returned to his capital, where he was praised by all classes of men. Text 54. Tatra tatro prasankliptair lasan makkarata torinai savrindai kadali stamhai Puga Potais Chatad Vidhai. The whole city was decorated with columns of banana trees containing bunches of fruits and flowers. And betel nut trees with leaves and branches were seen here and there. There were also many gates set up which were structured to give the appearance of sharks. Purport. Auspicious ceremonies with decorations of the green leaves of palms, coconut trees, betel nut trees and banana trees and fruits, flowers and leaves are an age-old custom in India. To receive his great son Dhruva Maharaj, King Uttanapada arranged a good reception and all the citizens very enthusiastically took part with great jubilation. Excuse me. Mute. Chuta Pallava Vasahasran Mukta Dhamma Vilambibhi Upaskritam Prati Dwaram Apam Kumbhai Sadi Pakai Deepakai. Lamps. At each and every gate there were burning lamps and big water pots decorated with differently coloured cloth, strings of pearls, flower garlands and hanging mango leaves.
Prakarair gopuragarai satakumba parichadai Savatolankritam Sriman Vimana Sikaradubhi.
In the capital city there were many palaces, city gates and surrounding walls, which were already very, very beautiful. And on this occasion all of them were decorated with golden ornaments. The domes of the city palaces glittered, as did the domes of the beautiful aeroplanes which hovered over that city. So, you know, this is just a bunch of primitives here. Purport regarding the mention of aeroplanes here. It is suggested by Srimad Vijayadvaj Tirtha that on this occasion the demigods from higher planetary systems also came in their aeroplanes. to bestow their blessings on Dhruva Maharaj on his arrival at the capital of his father. It also appears that all the domes of the city palaces, as well as the pinnacles of the airplanes, were decorated with ornamental work in gold, and being reflected by the sunshine, they were all glittering. We can observe a specific distinction between Dhruva Maharaja's time and modern days. For the airplanes in those days were made of gold, whereas at the present moment airplanes are made of base aluminium. This just gives a hint of the opulence of Dhruva Maharaja's days and the poverty of modern times. Mrishta chatvara ratyata margam chandana charchitam lajja chattai pushpafalais tandulair balabhir yutam. All the quadrangles, lanes and streets in the city and the raised sitting places at the crossings were thoroughly cleansed and sprinkled with sandalwood water and auspicious grains such as rice and barley and flowers, fruits and many other auspicious presentations were scattered all over the city. Dhruvaya patti drishtaya tatra tatra pura striyaha siddhata kshatta dhajyambu durva pushpa falani cha upajahu prayunjana vatsalyad asisha satihi shrinvam stadval gujitani pravishad bhavanam pituhu. Thus, as Dhruva Maharaj passed on the road, from every place in the neighbourhood, all the gentle household ladies assembled to see him, and out of maternal affection they offered their blessings, showering him with white mustard seed, barley, curd, water, newly grown grass, fruits and flowers. In this way, Dhruva Maharaj, while hearing the pleasing song sung by the ladies, entered the palace of his father. Mahamani Vratamaye Satasmin Bhavanotome Lalito Nitaram Pitra Nyavasa Dividevavat. Dhruva Maharaj thereafter lived in his father's palace, which had walls bedecked with highly valuable jewels. His affectionate father took particular care of him, and he dwelled in that house, just as the demigods live in their palaces in the higher planetary systems. Poya fena nibhasaya danta rukma parichadaha asanani maharhani yatra rukma upaskaraha. The bedding in the palace was as white as the foam of milk and was very soft. The bedsteads were made of ivory with embellishments of gold, and the chairs, benches and other sitting places and furniture were made of gold. Yatra svatika kudyeshu mahamarakateshu cha mani pradipa abhanti lalana ratna samyutaha. The palace of the king was surrounded by walls made of marble with many engravings made of valuable jewels like sapphires, which depicted beautiful women with shining jewel lamps in their hands. Purple description of King Uttanapada's palace depicts the state of affairs many hundreds and thousands of years ago, long before Srimad Bhagavatam was compiled. Since it is described that Maharaj Dhruva ruled for 36,000 years, he must have lived in the Satya Yuga, when people lived for 100,000 years. The life durations in the four yugas are also mentioned in the Vedic literature. In the Satya Yuga, people used to live for 100,000 years. In the Treta Yuga, people live for 10,000 years. In Dwapara Yuga, they live for 1,000 years. And in this age, Kali Yuga, people may live up to 100 years. With the progressive advance of each new yuga, the duration of human life is reduced by 90%. From 100,000 to 10,000, from 10,000 to 1,000, and from 1,000 to 100. It is said that Dhruva Maharaj was the great-grandson of Lord Brahma. This indicates that Dhruva Maharaj's time was in the Satya Yuga in the beginning of the creation. During one day of Lord Brahma, as stated in the Bhagavad Gita, there are many Satya Yugas. According to the Vedic calculation, at the present moment, the 28th millennium is current. It can be calculated that Dhruva Maharaj lived many millions of years ago, but the description of the palace of Dhruva's father is so glorious that we cannot accept that advanced human civilization did not exist even 40 or 50,000 years ago. There were walls like those in the palace of Maharaj Uttanapada even very recently during the Mughal period. Anyone who has seen the Red Fort in Delhi must have marked that the walls are made of marble and were once decorated with jewels. During the British period, all these jewels were taken away and dispatched to the British Museum. The conception of worldly opulence was formerly based mainly on natural resources such as jewels, marble, silk, ivory, gold, and silver. The advancement of economic development was not based on big motor cars. Advancement of human civilization depends not on industrial enterprises, but on possession of natural wealth and natural food, which is all supplied by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, so that we may save time for self-realization and success in the human form of body. Another aspect of this verse is that Dhruva Maharaj's father, Uttanapada, would very soon give up attachment for his palaces and would go to the forest for self-realization. From the descriptions of Srimad Bhagavatam, therefore, we can make a very thorough comparative study of modern civilization and the civilization of mankind in the other millenniums, Satya Yuga, Treta Yuga, and Dwapara Yuga.
Yakripatamaham bande Shri Guru Dinatavinam.
So we see here the kingdom of Maharaj Uttanapada. At the beginning of the Satya Yuga, at the beginning of the of this universal manifestation, and the description is of a very natural scene, in that there are people right? There are people. And there are people living in a city, right? Pura, Mayapur, Jagannath, Puri even. Pura means city. So, this is quite challenging because, you know, the notion of civilization is, in the current age, is that, you know, not so long ago we were primitives. Right, this is the notion, the idea. We were primitives. And that by the process of evolution we came from, you know, some primordial soup. Right? In fact, you know, the other day, the beginning of last week on the ABC television, right, they had a program called Stargazing. Right, Stargazing. They broke the world record for the amount of people looking at the moon and the stars. That's pretty big, right? Pretty important. But anyway, interesting. In that program, or a segment that I just happened to get a glimpse of, there's this famous scientist, Brian, is his name? I can't remember his name. Anyway, he's popularizing science. And so what they were doing was they got some dirt and they got some moisture and they got a whole bunch of stuff, right? And mixed it all up. It was the basis of, you know, this is supposedly the basis of creation. We came about as a result of a bunch of asteroids floating around in space, which was, again, as a result of a Big Bang. A Big Bang which came from nothing. Just read the leaves and kind of stuff. Right? So anyway, they then, these ingredients, they then put them all together with dry ice and froze them. Right? And then this was supposed to be the nature of an asteroid, of the asteroids that float around in space. Right? Okay. And then, and what happens is that when these asteroids are exposed to heat from stars, right, then the moisture that's contained within them, it evaporates and it produces gases. And I guess, you know, they're trying to illustrate, this is how life starts, from asteroids floating around in space. So, you know, as far as we're concerned, that's as far out, right, or certainly more far out than these descriptions here of civilization at the beginning of the creation. Right? And of course, within the Srimad Bhagavatam, we get a very logical and reasonable description of how the creation is unmanifest, right? At some point in time, just like us. Every Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, every creation is not manifest at a certain point in time, and then it's manifest, and then it disappears. Right? And that's our experience. That's what's happening to us. Right? Even as the earth. So this is not unusual, that things are not manifest at some point, then they appear, and then they disappear. Have you noticed that? Now, it's just going on all the time. There's a natural sequence of events. So, the Bhagavatam gives us a very different description of how the material creation didn't come from the Big Bang, right? Or certainly didn't come from nothing. This is ridiculous. How can you get something from nothing? How do you get something from nothing? The very definition of nothing is that there's nothing there. Right? It doesn't exist. Not that it's unmanifest, and then manifest, but nothing means nothing. There's nothing there. So this is, due to the lack of knowledge, the lack of understanding. Okay, and this is Krishna mentions, Maya Parita Jnana. The scientists and others have so much knowledge, so much, and shall we say, information, but they lack a proper understanding of how the creation actually comes about. Whereas in the Bhagavatam, we get a very reasonable description of events and circumstances and the structure of the creation, the structure of the material worlds, the structure of the spiritual world, how the spiritual world is an eternal place. It doesn't manifest or unmanifest. And it's not created. But it's something that's eternal. Right? Because that's quite a challenging concept for people to understand. Because they're stuck in the material world. We always see things unmanifest, manifest, then unmanifest again. And so within our experience, it's always changing. It's hard to conceive of. And this is why one has to hear from authorities like the Srimad Bhagavatam and hear why one hears from the Vedas. The Vedas are kind of like, if you buy a phone, right, along with the phone comes a manual, well, at least in the 80s when computers were just created, you used to get a computer, and then along with a computer you got a book about this thing. Right? It told you how to use it. Right? Same with the Vedas. Huge volumes of information contained within the Vedic literature. And summarized, right? Summarized in the Vedanta Sutra. Vedanta Sutra is a summary of all of the information that's contained within, the essential or the important spiritual knowledge that's contained within the Vedic literature is summarized within the Vedanta Sutra. And compiled by Vyasadeva at the beginning of the Kali Yuga, right? What for? Why did Vyasadeva compile the Vedic literature, especially the Vedanta Sutra? Why did he do that? Give us an edge, yeah. But also because previously the knowledge was given through oral reception. The guru would speak, the disciple would hear, and because they were shruti dhara, which means when they heard something, they remembered it. Right? When we hear something, we forget it. And so therefore Vyasadeva compiled everything, wrote it down so that we wouldn't forget it. So it wouldn't be forgotten. And because the Vedanta Sutra is such a compact, sutra means delivery of information concisely. And so the Vedanta Sutra is a bit like codes. But those codes need to be unpacked in order to be fully understood. And so therefore, in order for us to understand the Vedanta Sutra, which is the essence of Vedic knowledge, or effectively knowledge of where we've come from and where we should be going, this is effectively what it's all about, the Vedic literature, and it's like a manual. Just like there is a place where you can get the information on how to use your phone, it's usually online these days, we don't get it in a book, but the Vedic literature is just like the manual that comes with your phone that describes how to use it. And so The Vedanta Sutra was a because Vyasadeva compiled all of the Vedic literature, wrote it all down. But the essence, you know, the cream, the cream is considered to be the essence of the milk. So the cream of the Vedic literature was the Vedanta Sutra. And but because the Vedanta Sutra was so, what should we say, condensed, it needed a commentary. And that's why we have the Srimad Bhagavatam. The Srimad Bhagavatam is Vyasadeva's commentary on the Vedanta Sutra, so that we could understand the essence, or so we could understand the purpose of the Vedanta Sutra. And so at the beginning of the Bhagavatam, it mentions the Bhagavatam is our very means of conquest. Right? Bhagavatam is our very means of conquest. So here we have a description. Here's what's going on at the beginning of the creation. Right? These things are what we're doing is not something new or something made up or something created, but the activities that we are performing, we'll see consistently being performed throughout the description of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Right? There are streets. Well, there are people. People are living in buildings. Huh? Not, you know, living in caves. That's primitive, people live in caves. Huh? Your family may have come from people living in caves, but actually the Bhagavatam tells us, no, that's not where we come from. Our families are not monkeys. But the human form of life has been around since the beginning of creation. Right? Since the beginning. Hundreds of millions of years ago, at the beginning of the creation. And we find within the Vedic literature a description of all, you know, the periods of time, the cycles of yugas. It's inconceivable to us. We think 5,000. We tell people, "Oh, the Bhagavad Gita was spoken 5,000 years ago." They kind of scratch their heads. What do you mean 5,000 years ago? But the Bhagavatam tells us this information has been around for millions and millions and millions of years, and through cycles of yugas and cycles of creations, even. So, challenge. This is very challenging, actually. For those who believe that we came from monkeys, right? This kind of information is like, whoa, it's pretty far out stuff. But isn't it interesting? You know, this Prabhupada talks about progression. And you know, in Kali Yuga, people are proud, right? And so they think they're making progress. We think we've made progress, but if we actually look at the qualities of the age and the qualities of the people, and we look at the natural opulence of the city of Uttanapada, this is Uttanapadapura, right? Isn't it? That's what it is, Uttanapadapura. Most people won't be able to get their head around that name, right? One day Melbourne will be called Radhaballabhapura, right? Well, at least that's what we can call it. But here, interesting. Okay, how about this bit? Maharaj Dhruva ruled for 36,000 years. Right? That means he lived for 36,000 years. So, and Prabhupada says, okay, that means he's living in Satyayuga. Because in Satyayuga, people live for 100,000 years. And in the Vedic literature, each age is characterized by the fact that life's duration decreases by 90%. And we think we are advanced. We're advancing. What we don't realize is that we're not advancing it at all. We're at the lowest ebb of history, right, in the Kali Yuga. Is that right? Having a Mercedes motor car is not the be-all and end-all of life. Right? I wouldn't mind having one of these aeroplanes that they describe here, though. Right? But of course, those aeroplanes are the aeroplanes of the devatas. They're the aeroplanes of the demigods. So, you know, earthlings don't get they don't get the keys to that kind of car. They wouldn't know how to drive it. So, putting things into perspective. Dhruva Maharaj lived at a time which is right at the beginning of the creation, in such a yuga where everybody lived for 100,000 years, give or take. And that there have been many such yugas leading up till now. So we're in the 28th cycle, if you like, the 28th millennium. How many millenniums are there? 1,000? Is it? In the lifetime of the universe, how many millenniums are there? 1,000, isn't it? Yeah, 1,000. So we're in the 28th millennium, which means there's another... Prabhupada says it, the present moment, the 28th millennium is current. Yeah.
And the cycle of Manus is the 71 cycle of this.
Yugas. Divya Yugas.
Divya Yugas.
Satya, Treta, Dwapa, Kali. Anyway, this is mind-blowing. It's like, whoa! To get your head around this kind of stuff. And, you know, and then we're supposed to believe that we came from monkeys. And that this was primitives writing this literature. Right? People sitting around campfires, you know, just having a yarn. Right? What we call a yarn. Or the Ramayana, right? So Prabhupada's saying, if this kind of opulence and this kind of wealth and this kind of facility was present not so long ago, even on the Earth planet. But that Kali Yuga is a degradation. We're living in a period of not advancement, but we're living in a period of great degradation. And are fortunate to have the mercy of Vyasadeva. Are fortunate to have the mercy of Srila Prabhupada, because Prabhupada has understood the importance. But the previous acharyas, the Goswamis, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and his disciple, our founder acharya, understood the purpose of the Vedic literature, understood the purpose of the Srimad Bhagavatam. The Srimad Bhagavatam is given to us so that we can see the light of history through the proper prism, through the proper perspective, right? Through the proper... And understand the purpose of life, and the expansiveness of the whole creation, and that it's not just a big bang, which happened by chance. You know, but there's a solid purpose behind what we do, why we exist, why we're here, And how to then accept that, because that's not so easy when one understands one's purpose. That doesn't necessarily mean that you can then pursue it, right? Because Prabhupada mentions that we're in material life, even if, or shall we say, in spiritual life, even if we understand what our purpose is, we're so attracted to material things, we can't pursue our spiritual life. Sound familiar? Huh?
Very much.
Yeah, we're struggling. He upadrutaha. We're disturbed. We're disturbed by material desires and distracted by, you know, a so-called advanced civilization, which actually isn't advanced at all, because all it does is disturb you and create obstacles in your spiritual progress. That's what Kali Yuga is designed for. And so it's interesting that if one is able to see with the light of the Srimad Bhagavatam and see things in the proper perspective and recognize the obstacles and take advantage, because the Bhagavatam gives us the skill set or the tools, if you like, the tools by which we can identify the obstacles and then avoid them, not be distracted from our spiritual life. That's why the Bhagavatam is described as our very means of conquest. Isn't it? Huh? Bhagavatam is described as the very means of conquest. And so we're given these tools in the Srimad Bhagavatam to actually make a success out of our lives. And so that's why we reckon Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya, right? Regularly rendering service to the Srimad Bhagavatam by hearing it every day, Nitya Seva. Just like we worship, the worship of the deity is called Nitya Seva. Well, Nitya Seva means the regular worship, and then the Naimittika Seva, which is the festivals and the special events that are performed on occasion. Right? But there's the regular service of the deities that's required to make gradual spiritual advancement. So all this is described or outlined in the Srimad Bhagavatam. You know, that this culture of spiritual emancipation has been practiced and successfully completed for millennia, since the beginning of creation. It's not something that's just popped up. And that the real opulence of life is to pursue spiritual advancement or spiritual practice, spiritual progress. And of course, spiritual progress comes automatically from regular practice. Nitya Bhagavata Sevaya, regular service to Krishna. And developing the good habits of a sadhika. And learning, you know, surrender means learning to what to accept and what to reject. Because we're living in a culture that tells us, you know, accept all of the things that are actually bad for your spiritual life, that's good. And reject any of the things that are good for your spiritual life because they're bad. This is the culture of demons. Right? And of course, we're born in demons' families and we think, yeah, this is good. Actually, it's not good, it's bad. Because demons don't know the difference between what you should do and what you shouldn't do. Right? This is our culture. But the Bhagavatam introduces us to, you know, this natural, simple living. Learn how to value, what have we got here? Jewels, marble, silk, ivory, gold and silver. Food, right? What does Prabhupada say? It says here, Advancement of human civilization depends not on industrial enterprises, but on possession of natural wealth and natural food. Right? When you have a good meal of prasadam, how do you feel? Happier than any of the other kind of stimulation that you can get. Right? You know Korma's philosophy on prasadam? You can have a fantastic program, but if the prasadam's bad, everybody will complain about the prasadam. Right? But if you have a terrible program, but you have good prasadam, nobody will complain because they got a good feed. Right? So isn't that, this is natural. You know, like I always used to go and visit my grandma on Thursdays, and I never visited my mum and dad or my brothers because I was fighting with my dad, and what I discovered last month when I was visiting my father, that myself and my father are very similar. And because of that, we would, you know, there'd be a clash. So, but my grandma loved me regardless of the fact that my hair was long, my jeans were dirty, and I was out of it. So, and but the thing that I used to go and visit my grandma for was a good feed. You know, and the, I don't, you know, there's nothing better than what your grandma cooks, because she cooks with devotion, she cooks with love and affection for her family. Right? So, you know, going to grandma's for dinner was an event. Right? It was a significant event. And, you know, all you do is feel satisfied after you've had a decent feed. Simple. These are very simple things. Right? And so Vedic culture teaches us to be happy with simple things. And, of course, for us, you know, we wouldn't touch grandma's cooking now with a barge pole because it's boga and other unmentionable things. But the principle of love and devotion still remains. And of course, you know, we appreciate that food offered to Krishna with love and devotion is fully satisfying. Huh? Fully satisfying. So these are simple things. Taking prasadam. Bhunte bo jayate jayva. Right? Rupa Goswami recommends. These are essential elements of civilized culture. Bhavananda used to tell us the story of the wealthy citizens of Calcutta, the wealthy Vaishnavas, right? On Janmashtami, they would spend lots of money cooking feasts for their worship of their Radha Krishna deities, right? It was Vaishnava culture. They would naturally worship their local Radha and Krishna, usually the deities of the prominent wealthy men. And then those wealthy people would go around and visit each other's place of worship and just enjoy seeing all of the varieties of offerings that have been made to the deities. And they'd be satisfied by that. They weren't even eating. Right? This is a devotee. A devotee, you know, not concerned. He's just cooked a feast and he's thinking, oh, when's the offering done? Right? And he's thinking, oh, when can I eat the feast? The very advanced devotees, not concerned about eating. He's happy to see that Krishna got a very nice offering. And he's not thinking, you know, what's in it for me. He's thinking, oh, look how nicely Krishna's been served here. How satisfying. Let me have a little, some Mahaprasadam. And this is culture, huh? but it is culture. To just to appreciate how nicely Krishna is. And of course, one of the reasons why this community of devotees has been successful is because the focus and attention to the details of serving Radha Ballabha and Gaur-Nitai and Jagannath Balaram Subhadra have been adhered to. Standards, right? Good standards of worship means that Krishna's pleased, right? This is why we have standards of cleanliness in the kitchen. Not because we're, you know, cleanliness freaks, although we are, right? But why we do that? Because we know that's pleasing to Krishna. This is the culture, huh? This is the culture. What did Prabhupada say? Simple living, high thinking. That's what we should be focused on. Of course, we're not always perfect in that regard. But that's our... And the Bhagavatam reminds us of that. These stories remind us of the proper values. Of course, that's Prabhupada's mission and part of education, part of what we teach. What is it? Knowledge, skills, and what's next? Who's done TTC1? Values, yeah. Knowledge, skills, and values. And Prabhupada mentions that in the beginning of the example that's used is the beginning of the seven purposes of ISKCON, right? To teach the knowledge of spiritual practice, of spiritual life. This is the first purpose of ISKCON, right? And to teach the techniques, Prabhupada says, the techniques of spiritual life, which we find in the Bhagavatam. And the techniques, and to write the values, the imbalance of values. So Prabhupada mentions knowledge or learning, skills, and then the values. And so that's what we're getting from the Bhagavatam here in this vision of Uttanapada's welcome of Dhruva Maharaj back to his home, Uttanapadapura, right? Or Uttanapadapuri, we can call it. Prabhupada says that the advancement of economic development was not based on big motor cars. Although, that doesn't mean that we neglect our motor cars. Right? It's Krishna's chariot and we should keep it, you know, like I got my car clean yesterday. I just don't like dirty cars. But then to take me down to pick up the car, I got in the Volkswagen market van. Has anybody seen the front seat of that van? Recently? Well, it's not recent actually, it's been like that for a while. Have you looked at it? You know, I said to the pilot, I said, I'm going to be moochy sitting in this thing. I think it's got a new, we're creating a new species of bacteria in that seat. So I told Tom, let's take it down and get it, clean that van. It doesn't get clean. Why don't we clean it? Oh, everybody uses it, nobody cleans it. That's clear. That's obvious. Right? Pretty obvious. We need to, you know, and women can't laugh because their calves are pretty filthy too. Not all the time. Here, it's described here. And then they're decorated with yogurt and scented sandalwood and mango leaves, and just it's all fresh and clean and smells nice, right? Sandalwood, to make it smell good. This is all culture. lighting incense. You know, devotees sometimes say, why do we offer incense to Krishna? Why do we offer a lamp? Why do we offer water? Why do we offer flowers? Why do we, you know, we're so uncultured. Right? This is a measure of our lack of culture, that we ask these stupid questions. Right? And you see here, in this culture here, everybody knows these are symptoms of cleanliness, symptoms of goodness, symptoms of offering everything to Krishna. The items that we offer represent all of the different elements, the basic elements. What is it? We call it the Pancha Mahabhuta. Is that right? Right? And we're offering what ultimately belongs to Krishna to him. Right? It's a reminder. Hello, wake up. This is Krishna's, not yours. Right? Idam Krishna, idam na mama. That's the yajna, that's the sacrifice. And of course, you know, in modern society, we're thinking, I am an Australian, I love my country, we are Australians, this is Australia, hands off you Chinese, you name it. Whoever's, you know, there's a big worry at the moment that the Chinese are coming to get us. Huh? They're infiltrating society, they're influencing our elections, and they're taking control. Well, better get used to it. It isn't going to get less, it's going to get more. So, you know, it doesn't belong to the Chinese, doesn't belong to the Australians, whoever they might be, right? Who are the Australians? You know, it's all very temporary. And so, you know, this culture is meant to teach us the realities of existence, the realities of history, in that the type of culture that we should be embracing and of course then demonstrating to others is this culture that's mentioned here in the Bhagavad Gita. And as Prabhupada says at the end, the real purpose, even you have this culture, one has to give it up. One has to give it up. Right? And go to the forest. Whoa. Dhruva Maharaja's father, Uttanapada, would very soon give up attachment for his palaces and would go to the forest for self-realization. That's pretty far out. Which forest are we going to for self-realization? Huh? No. Hare Krishna Valley? Oh? Yeah. Hare Krishna Valley, live in the forest? Or Vrindavan? Who here is going to go and live in Vrindavan in the last days of their lives? Yes. Raise your hands. Realistically. Not easy living in Vrindavan, is it, Sukadev? If I stay in Vrindavan for too long, I'd get really sick. The dust of Vrindavan. Ooh, kill ya. Huh? No? Try walking around Vrindavan every day in Kartik. You've got to go out really early. Otherwise, if you go out in the afternoon, you're a dead man. The pollution, everything. Ooh. Interesting, isn't it? But, you know, that's the thing. We have to, at some point, give up our attachment for material, well, for our palaces. Anybody here got palaces? But this is the point is that at some point we have to detach from material and attach to spiritual. A lot of what we do here is that's what we're doing already. We don't need to go to the forest because everything that we do here is focused on serving Krishna. Huh? The idea of going to the forest doesn't mean literally that we go to the forest. Because, you know, if you went to live in the forest, say if you went to live in the forest near Hare Krishna Valley, how would you live? What would you eat? In a Satyayuga, you could go and live in the forest and you'd be sumptuously taken care of, right? But in the Kali Yuga, go and try and live in the forest. And, you know, there's descriptions of how they just eat wearing the bark of trees. Right? You reckon you could live in the forest at Hare Krishna Valley? Krishna, what do you reckon? And wear the bark, the stringy bark, right, of a tree. But the point is, give up attachment for material things, attach yourself to the spiritual. That's the whole purpose of going to the forest. So in one sense, we don't need to go to the forest. If we live in Albert Park, you know, this is our forest, huh? And our attachment to spiritual things is to serve the deities. Well, such a valuable thing. That's how we become detached, is by getting a higher taste, by becoming attached to serving Krishna. And Srila Prabhupada very kindly brought Radha Vallabha here for us so that we could do that. That's how we make spiritual progress in this day and age. And we preach. This is our system. Attach ourselves to Krishna and then go out and tell others that's what they should be doing. And that's enough. Chant Hare Krishna and preach. Prabhupada says, from the description of Srimad Bhagavatam, therefore, we can make a very thorough comparative study of modern civilization and the civilization of mankind in the other millenniums, such as Yuga, Treta Yuga, and Dwapara Yuga. Interesting. Okay, don't you ask Srimad Bhagavatam? Do anyone have any comments, questions? Sometimes he does sit, but we don't see it. If you go to Jagannath Puri, go to the Toda Gopinath temple, and you'll see him sitting. He can do anything. Krishna can do anything. Most of the time he stands, but sometimes he sits also. And he stands for the pleasure of his devotees. And he sits for the pleasure of his devotees too. And it's easier to dress him when he's standing. Huh? If you sat down when your mum was trying to dress you, what would she say? What would your mum say? If you sat down while she was trying to dress you, what would she say? Stand up. Yeah. So that's why he stands. He looks good that way. See, you know, we're like Krishna. We like people looking at us. But we get that because Krishna likes people looking at him. When he's got a new set of clothes on, he likes to look his best. In this day and age, people think they look good without clothes on. But Krishna teaches us, you know, what is civilization? Anything else? Okay. Another question? No? Everybody's at the booth, even the Mataji is at the booth, in that we are the servant of all of these persons. And so, regardless of gender, the devotees are our masters. There's an interesting video. Prabhupada saying that all of his disciples should be recognized as Prabhu. Right? Because they're all pure devotees. Anybody who's trying to chant Hare Krishna, follow the process of devotional service, they're considered to be perfect, right? It's mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita. And so Prabhupada was making a comment on the propaganda that was being propagated by some of the devotees, that a particular devotee was a pure devotee and that he alone should be followed and served. And Prabhupada said, this is nonsense. All of my disciples are pure devotees. Why only this one is a pure devotee and we should only follow him? Right? We hear this from time to time within ISKCON, especially when devotees become overly enamoured by their guru and they start saying, oh, my guru is a pure devotee and we should all follow him and don't worry about the others because they're not pure devotees. Well, Prabhupada said, this is a nonsense idea. Right? Everybody should be honoured and respected as Prabhu, which means I am your servant. It's Prabhupada's point. Right? And that all of the devotees, sincere devotees who are following the orders of the spiritual master, following the process of bhakti, they're all advanced, actually. All pure devotees. But we somehow think that just because a person becomes a Diksha Guru, then all of a sudden they're better than everybody else. And it's kind of like, where does that philosophy come from? Where does that come? Where is that philosophy in our books? It doesn't come from our philosophy. Actually, it comes from sentimentalism. That's where it comes from. It's not actually our philosophy. Our philosophy is that everybody is a devotee. If somebody initiates others, that doesn't make him better than everybody else, necessarily. He may be more advanced, but not necessarily. That doesn't mean better. Huh? So we have to be careful. We should treat everybody as Prabhu. And Prabhupada didn't like it that one Prabhu was considered, you know, over and over. Because, mind you, Rupa Goswami does tell us we have to discriminate between the different types of devotees, and we do. But just because somebody is initiating and others are not, doesn't mean that the person who is initiating is automatically better than others. They may be more advanced than the person who's initiating. How do you know? That's not the criteria. You know? There are other criteria by which we determine whether a devotee is advanced or not. And it's not by the number of disciples that they have, or even that they're actually initiating. It's not. But out of sentimentality, we think. Because there's this notion in all cultures, pretty much, that, you know, there are people who are more advanced than others, which is true, spiritually, and that we want a guru. And the guru is going to... And there's this kind of idea in Indian culture, even in Western culture, that person, that special person, is going to save us. Huh? They walk on water, or they read minds, or they, you know, do all sorts of stuff. Or they can solve all of our problems. There's another idea, another weird idea. You've got a guru, and yes, they should be able to. But what are all the problems? All of the problems, or how are all the problems solved? All of the problems are solved if we start worshipping Krishna, right? And take on the process of devotional service. That's how we solve all of our problems. But we have this notion that if I take, that somehow there's this, that a guru is a superman who knows everything about me and everyone else and can solve all of my problems. Right? But very often, some gurus that we know within ISKCON, they can't even remember the names of their disciples. So how is it that they know everything? Huh? Or know everyone and all things about everyone? Or certainly all things about me, when they can't remember my name? What does that mean? So in one sense... we have to keep everything we have to keep things in perspective. And even a little Prabhu, like here, we are his servant, right? Or a Mataji. Right, a Mataji is, we can also serve, right? And they are our master, you know? So when your wife tells you what to do, what do? Ignore it, right? No, not a wise thing to do. So that's interesting, you know, understanding at what point or at which point we are a servant and then behaving appropriately in each of those settings. And be a see everybody as Prabhu, even the Matajis. That's a real tricky one. Knowing our own, and this is part of self-realization. Part of self-realization is understanding where we are on the path of perfection, and you know where we're not perfect, right? And what we need to do to move to the next stage of perfection. Did you get that, Krishna? Yep. Okay, Ganarashima Bhagavatam Ki Jai, Sala Prabhupada Ki Jai, Gaura Bhaktivinoda Ki Jai.